Welcome to Torat Imecha Nachyomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Michelle Levine, and today we are studying Perek Hei, Chapter 5 of the Book of Daniel. This chapter marks the climactic culmination of the first four chapters in Sefer Daniel. For as the last verse of this chapter records, the kingdom of Babylonia falls with the assassination of its last king, Belshazzar. The next chapter, chapter 6, will begin with the rule of Darius the Mede, whose reign will eventually be supplanted by the Persian king Cyrus the Great at the helm. Nebuchadnezzar is genealogically referred to as Belshazzar's father in this chapter. Commentators such as the Barbanel and Mitzudat David maintain that based on Yirmiyahu's prophecy in 27:7, that all nations would serve Nebuchadnezzar, his son, and his grandson, that Belshazzar was the son of Evil-Merodach, who is not mentioned in the book of Daniel, but noted in 2 Kings chapter 25, and the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. Therefore, the epithet father refers to grandfather. As a point of observation, modern historians claim, through their translation of cuneiform inscriptions, that Belshazzar was the son of the king Nabonidus. Historical records show that Nabonidus was not an active king during much of his reign, but left for the desert Tema in Arabia to worship his preferred god, the moon god, and he entrusted his son, Belshazzar, to carry on the kingship. As such, Belshazzar became the de facto king of Babylon during his father's absence. Therefore, referring to Nebuchadnezzar as Belshazzar's father can imply more broadly his predecessor. Other scholars maintain it is quite plausible that Belshazzar's mother was Nebuchadnezzar's daughter, in which case Nebuchadnezzar is his grandfather. Notably, Abarbanel in his commentary Mayane HaYeshua, Wells of Salvation 7:1, observes that while there were other kings of Babylonia, and for that matter Persia, they are not cited in the book of Daniel, because they do not serve the purposes for this Sefer of Tanakh, to focus on the destiny of Am Yisrael in relation to world empires, and to highlight the importance of the persona of Daniel himself. In this regard, it is noteworthy that Nebuchadnezzar's ordeal described in the previous chapter 4 has been correlated to a parallel experience which Nabonidus endured, albeit with distinct differences. And this torment is recorded in a text found in the Qumran caves, the Prayer of Nabonidus. Nabonidus is described as praying to the God Most High after having been healed from a bad disease with which he had been smitten for 7 years, an affliction whose nature is not revealed. Nabonidus proclaims he was directed to praise this god by an unnamed Jewish diviner from among the exiles, who appears after the king has been smitten, revealing that Nabonidus had been afflicted by God as punishment for his sin. One might speculate that the association between the ordeals of these two kings highlights the connection between Nebuchadnezzar, the first and dominant Babylonian monarch, who exemplified the hubris of this kingship, and the last king, Belshazzar, a co-regent for his father Nabonidus. Nebuchadnezzar's humiliation is then correlated with Belshazzar's ultimate defeat. At the opening of this episode, however, we encounter Belshazzar making a great feast to 1,000 of his nobles, with much wine being drunk at this party, as related in verse 1. Why is he celebrating? Rashi cites the 10th century Jewish Italian historian Josipan, who often relies on the works of Josephus, that while Belshazzar was being attacked by the Medes and Persians, he had just won a battle against them, saving the capital city of Babylon. Intriguingly, this is corroborated in the Nabonidus Chronicle, inscribed in cuneiform on a clay tablet. This feast was apparently intended to boost morale, but also to boost the sovereignty of Belshazzar. Yet, as Yeshayahu 21:5-9 had already predicted, Hashem determined that during a party, the enemy would return and Babylonia would fall. Indeed, Greek historians such as Herodotus and Xenophon attest that the Persians captured Babylonia in 539 BCE, while the Babylonians were feasting and in a drunken revelry. Our sages note there is greater intention for Belshazzar to be festive. As noted in the Hebrew chronological work Seder Olam Rabbah, chapter 28, and see as well Masechet Megillah 11b, Belshazzar is celebrating because, according to his calculations, the Babylonian Empire is not destined to fall as was predicted by Yirmiyahu. According to Yirmiyahu, Babylonia was supposed to last for only 70 years, and Belshazzar calculated these years from the beginning of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. Since these 70 years have now concluded, and Am Yisrael has not been redeemed to return to the land of Israel, Belshazzar is emboldened to falsely assume that his empire will not be vanquished by the Persians. With brazenness to demonstrate his overblown confidence, we learn in verse 2 that Belshazzar commands to bring the golden and silver vessels that Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, Dihanapek Nebuchadnezzar Avuhi, min Hechla di Virushlem, in order for everyone, himself, his nobles, wives, concubines, to drink from them. Belshazzar does what Nebuchadnezzar had never dared to do. Recall that in chapter 1, Nebuchadnezzar has stored the holy Kelim vessels of the Beit HaMikdash in the treasure house of his temple, recognizing their holiness. In arrogant defiance of Hashem's sovereignty and in order to humiliate the Jews, Belshazzar, with his entire attendant entourage, drink wine from them. And as related in verses 3 through 4 in their drunken state, they praise the gods of gold, silver, brass, iron, wood, and stone, with the intent to show the dominance of their gods. Yet many of these referenced medals remind us of the composition of the statue that Nebuchadnezzar had dreamed about in chapter 2, when he was told by Daniel that his empire would not last eternally, but there would be a succession of kingdoms. And the stone reminds us of the stone that had destroyed the statue in this dream. As well, the wood recalls Nebuchadnezzar's tree dream, in which he is humiliated for his own arrogance. Defying these dreams and flouting their predicted divine historical plan, as Belshazzar presumes they are no longer relevant, Belshazzar drinks from the holy vessels of the Beit HaMikdash. Perhaps as well with this insolent act, he also aimed to upstage Nebuchadnezzar, the great Babylonian king, and prove his own dominion will last. And this point will become evident in Daniel's rebuke of Belshazzar. Such a sacrilegious act cannot go unpunished. With the guiding word Nun Pei Kuf Nafak, which had been used in verses 2 through 3 to refer to the taking out of these vessels for drinking, we learn of the Midah Keneged Midah cause-effect actions of Hashem against this disdainful king. As verse 5 relates, in the same hour, fingers of a man's hand came forth, Ba Sha'ata Nefaka Etzba'an Diyad Enash, and wrote over against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the palm of the hand that wrote. As Rashi elaborates, the appearance of the fingers of a human hand unattached to a body emerged from heaven and writes without a writing utensil on the plaster of a wall that was near a source of light, so it was visible to everyone. As Malbim observes, this is not a private vision to the king himself, but a miraculous phenomenon meant for all to witness. The king reacts with shock and panic. As verse 6 relates, then the king's countenance changed, his thoughts alarmed him, and the knots of his loins were loosened, v'kitre chartze mishtarayin, and his knees knocked one against the other. Note the graphic progression of his dread, like a ripple effect, from his face to his mind to his loins and knees. Indeed, this scene has been pictorially captured in one of Rembrandt's most famous paintings in 1635, titled Belshazzar's Feast. In this painting, the hand is illuminated as appearing from a dark cloud, as is the writing. So the viewer is drawn to it, and it captures the moment of shock and puzzlement, as everyone, especially the king, is appalled and baffled by the writing on the wall. Immediately, as we learn in verse 7, he summons in a loud voice to bring in all his wise men to read and interpret the writing on the wall. Belshazzar is so panicked, he guarantees immense rewards, promising that whoever fulfills his demand will be clothed in purple, with a chain of gold on their neck. And even more, V'talti b'malchuta yishlat, meaning the person will rule either one-third of the kingdom, or that person will rule as part of a triumvirate under the king. Note that as opposed to Nebuchadnezzar, he does not append a threat to those who do not do his will. Perhaps this also reflects his insecurities at this moment. But the wise men fail to read and interpret the writing on the wall, causing more panic as verses 8 through 9 relate. The obvious question is, why could they not even read the writing on the wall? As will become apparent, the message was written in Aramaic, as such Daniel interprets it. Nevertheless, our sages teach the letters could not be parsed into comprehensible words for various reasons. Among the opinions cited in Masechet Sanhedrin 22a, Rav posits the letters were written in a system of gematria, the Atbash system, so that to decipher the words, one needs to exchange the letters with their counterpart from the other end in the alphabet. Thus, if the letter Taf is written, it is meant to be read as an Aleph, and so forth. Shmuel claimed the letters had to be read vertically and not horizontally. Rav Yochanan maintained each word was written backwards, and Rav Ashi claims that only the first two letters were reversed and thus needed to be rearranged to decipher the writing. From among these four opinions, Rembrandt's painting follows that of Shmuel, who claimed the writing was written horizontally but read vertically. Rembrandt lived in Amsterdam, where there was a strong Jewish presence in the 1600s, and there is speculation he learned this opinion from the local rabbi Manasseh Israel. Interestingly, this is the opinion preferred by Mitzudat David as well. While everyone is stymied by this portentous event, a queen appears and tells Belshazzar she will resolve all his concerns. Who is this queen? Most probably she is not Belshazzar's wife, as all of his wives have already been present at this party. Perhaps, as Malbim posits, she is his grandmother. Or, as Abalbanel prefers, she is the most prestigious wife to whom was given the exclusive title of queen, who had not at that time taken part in the drunken festivities. This queen tells Belshazzar, as reported in verses 11 through 12, "There is a man in your kingdom, in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. And in the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, was found in him." The queen refers to Daniel as to one to whom is the spirit of the holy gods, Ruach Elohim Kadishin, in the plural, speaking from a pagan perspective. She references Nebuchadnezzar and notes how he promoted Daniel to be the head of all the wise men, which apparently Belshazzar ignored, because how could he not be aware of Daniel? While Daniel has had a long career and reputation as dream interpreter in the Babylonian palace, Belshazzar does not seem to have any kind of relationship with him. She mentions Daniel's Babylonian name, Belteshazzar, which is not mentioned otherwise in this chapter, presumably because it is too close to the name of the king himself, Belshazzar. In the course of praising Daniel for his great wisdom and understanding, she references in verse 12 how Daniel has the ability to loosen knots, umeshare kitrin, a literary echo of the earlier depiction of the king's panic when the knots of his loins were untied. As noted by scholars, this is intentional. The king's consternation, exhibited in a physiological sense, will be allayed by Daniel, who will be able to untie the knots figuratively, for he will resolve the riddle of the writing on the wall and propose its interpretation. In verses 13 through 16, when the king summons Daniel, he refers to him in verse 13 as Daniel, who is of the children of the captivity of Judah, whom the king, my father, that is Nebuchadnezzar, brought out of Judah. Identifying Daniel by his Judean roots and acknowledging Daniel has been in exile for a long time, he highlights Daniel's foreignness, perhaps meant with a nuance to be demeaning. And yet, he acknowledges what the queen has made known to him about Daniel's exceptional wisdom. As such, he reiterates all the rewards he will bestow on Daniel, if indeed he can accomplish what all his wise men have failed to do. Daniel, however, does not immediately solve the king's problems. First, in verse 17, he spurns the offer of rewards, refusing to accept this bribe as if Hashem's services can be bought, and also to avoid being beholden to the king. This might remind us of Avraham Avinu's refusal to accept wealth from the king of Sodom in Bereshit chapter 14, exclaiming, "So you shall not say, I have made Avraham rich." Furthermore, he chides Belshazzar by highlighting his fatal error in not learning from his very ancestor, Nebuchadnezzar. In his speech of verses 18 through 24, Daniel recalls Nebuchadnezzar's glory, majesty, and extensive powers, and highlights how Nebuchadnezzar's arrogance and pride led to grave consequences when, as had been related in chapter 4, he was deposed from his throne, given the mind of an animal, driven from society, living among the beasts, even among wild donkeys, a fact not related in the previous chapter. Yet, Nebuchadnezzar ultimately acknowledges that the God Most High is sovereign over the kingdoms of men, and sets over them whomever he wishes. But Belshazzar chastises Daniel in verses 22 through 23, allowed his pride to cause him to be so audacious as to desecrate the vessels of God's temple and drink from them and praise their pagan gods, which do not see or hear or know, without honoring the God who holds your life in his hands and all your ways. Concludes Daniel, it is this haughtiness which has precipitated the writing on the wall. For, as Daniel will now interpret from verses 25 through 28, God has decreed the demise of Belshazzar and the downfall of the Babylonian Empire on this very night. Daniel reads the writing, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Ufalsin. And then he provides the interpretation, Mene, Mena, Elaha, Malchutach, Vahashlema, Tekel, Tekilta, Bemozania, Vihishtechachat, Chasil. Peres, Perisat Malchutach, Vihivat Lemadai Ufaras. The mention of Mozania, scales, indicates that Daniel interprets these words in relation to Hashem's standards of justice and judgment. As Saadia Gaon reflects, associating Proverbs 16:11 to our context, and interestingly, that chapter in Proverbs speaks about the powers and obligations of a king. Peles umoznei mishpat Lashem, Maaseu kol avnechis. Rashi interprets, Hashem will appraise a person according to his deeds, weighing them as if on scales. And just as among the weights in a bag, there are large and small weights. So everything is assessed according to a person's deeds. So too, Belshazzar's deeds are evaluated on the divine scales of justice. Based on Hashem's standards for kings, he is judged and his verdict is pronounced. Presumably, this concept would also not be foreign to Belshazzar. Ancient Egyptian paintings depict soul weighing, where in the afterlife there is a scale, where on one side a person's heart is weighed and judged against a feather on the other side, which is the symbol for the Egyptian goddess of justice. In Babylonian mythos, the sun god Shamash, who was also the god of justice, is associated with the symbol of scales. And the constellation of Libra is associated in Babylonian astronomy with scales. As such, scholarship has suggested, as noted by Yehuda Kiel and Shmuel HaKohen in Dat Mikra, that the first three words of each phrase, when Daniel repeats them before proceeding to parse their specific interpretation, Mene, Tekel, Peres, may refer to standard weight stones. Archaeological discoveries have found weight stones with the values written on them of a mina, a tekel, or a peres, which is half a mina. Yechezkel 45:12 speaks of the values of shekel, and shin is interchangeable with taf, and a maneh. And Mishnah Ediyot 3:3 speaks of a unit of measure maneh, and half a maneh, which is a pas. The act of the divine assessment of the worth of the Babylonian kingdom under Belshazzar's sovereignty is then described in a threefold pattern in the next part of Daniel's interpretation. Mina Elaha Malchutach. The verb mena is rendered by commentators as Saadia Gaon and Mitzudat David to mean Hashem has numbered your kingdom, with the assumption this means Hashem has numbered the days of Belshazzar's kingdom, determining they are limited, for his kingship is over. Other readings apply the Aramaic mena to refer to a more specific meaning of appraising. That is, on the scales of justice, Hashem is assessing the value of Belshazzar's kingdom to determine if he measures up to Hashem's standards. In a similar vein, this is the meaning of the next phrase associated with Tekel, Tekilta Bemozania. Here, Hashem is not mentioned specifically, but a passive verb Tekilta is applied, although it is understood Hashem is performing this action. As Mitzudat David explains, this refers to Belshazzar's dominion being weighed on the divine scales, rendering tekilta as nishkalta, interchanging the taf for a shin in Hebrew. And thirdly, this is reiterated in the last part of Daniel's interpretation, prisat malchutach. Scholars have noted that the Aramaic verb pe resh samech means assess. Once again, in this phrase, we have the stipulation that Belshazzar's kingdom is being evaluated. This rendering of Pe Resh Samech is attested in Targum Onkelos' understanding of Vayikra chapter 27, where he translates the Hebrew verb Ve'erich with an ayin, making a valuation, to the Aramaic V'ifros. Once the actions of divine judgment and appraisal have been described, the question becomes, what is the verdict? Daniel interprets in a threefold manner. First, Vehashlema. Sa'adya Gaona Mitzudat David rendered this to mean that your days are complete, that is, brought to an end. On the other hand, one could juxtapose this verb to the verb l'shalem. That is, Belshazzar's verdict is that his kingdom is going to be paid out, for he has lost his right to rule. Once Belshazzar has been weighed and his value appraised, he will now be handed over, in this case, to another empire. In a correlative manner, Tehillim 137:8 exclaims the hope, Bat Bavel Hashtuda, Ashrei Sheyishalem Lach et Gemulech Shegamart Lanu. By handing over and paying out Babylonia to another empire, Hashem is paying back the Babylonians for all the suffering they have caused Am Yisrael. Similarly, V'hishtechachat chasir. When Belshazzar was assessed on the divine scales of justice, he was found to be deficient in weight. He did not measure up to Hashem's sovereign standards. And as Mitzudat Davi exclaims, he has no merits to tip the scales in his favor. Therefore, he deserves punishment. Accordingly, Vihivat lemadai ufaras. Belshazzar is being given over to media in Persia with the play on words of Peres ufarsim prisat, implying his downfall, particularly to Persia. In fact, some commentators render prisat malchutach in relation to the Hebrew verb pei resh samech to mean that his kingdom will be shattered and divided between media and Persia. While Daniel has just predicted the demise of Belshazzar's rulership, Belshazzar commands in verse 29 that Daniel receive all the rewards promised, including that he will rule either one-third of the kingdom or as part of a triumvirate. Yet how could he fulfill this latter promise? Seemingly, as Malbim interprets, Belshazzar thought this decree won't happen for a long time. But as we noted, Belshazzar is killed on that very night, possibly by Cyrus the Great's generals, as recorded by the Greek historian Xenophon. Rav Chaim Dov Rabinowitz, in his commentary Da'at Soferim, teaches the important lesson to be gleaned from this chapter. Hashem is watching and supervising with his Hashgacha Pratit over the entire world. Hashem wants the nations of the world to know they are being judged for their actions. They are responsible for their actions, and their destinies are controlled and determined by Hashem. Their fates will be reckoned and sealed by Hashem's divine standards of justice. This lesson is also apparent in the parallel event of Ahasuerus's parties at the beginning of Megillat Esther. As the Gemara Masechet Megillah 12a teaches, Ahasuerus also took out the holy vessels of the Beit HaMikdash to drink from them at his parties, and he was even wearing the clothing of the Kohen Gadol, flaunting his presumption that the Jews would never be fully redeemed. The Gemara relates that a bat kol, a divine voice, rings forth and rebukes, "You have brazenly not learned from the mistakes of Belshazzar, whose fate was sealed when he desecrated the holy Kelim vessels, and your fate will be sealed as well." On what night was Belshazzar assassinated? Our sages teach that fittingly it was the night of Pesach. As we read in the Haggadah and the Piyut of Ayehi b'chatzi alayla, Mishtaker b'chle kodesh neherag bo balayla. When Belshazzar became drunk with the holy vessels on that night of Pesach, he was killed. The takeaway message is Hashem is always looking out for us to protect us from our enemies, and that this vengeance against Babylonia took place on Pesach is the sure sign of his providence over Am Yisrael. This shiur is dedicated by Arlene and Arthur Ice and Michelle and Dove Schwartz and families. Le'ilui Nishmat, our beloved and much missed father, William T. Steinlauf, Tritel Ze'ev Ben Baruch, on his 25th yahrzeit. His love of Hashem, Torah, community, and family has served us as an inspiration and guide for his children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren.